This is the last session on ethics, dilemmas in reproductive health care. And this session I want to focus on the rationing of health care within our country. And the first question I want to ask for people is, just kind of quickly off the top of your head, do you consider health care to be a right or a privilege? Right. Think about that for a minute, and then I'll do hand raising. Hi. How many people think healthcare is a right? Okay. How many people think? Yeah, should be a right. How many people think healthcare should be a right? Okay. And how many people think it should be a privilege? Okay. We are caught in a system in our society where we have, in some cases, said that it is a right, and yet we function as if it's a privilege. Especially if you don't have a certain kind of health insurance or if you're a certain income level. And so while many people have considered all along, I mean, you have, you know, health, food, shelter, and health care as part of the American dream. And yet for years, our health care system has functioned in a 2 to 3 tiered system. The first tier is for people who are insured or people with money. They get a certain kind of health care. They get access to certain technologies, access to certain kind of health care facilities, access to certain doctors and medical research, et cetera. The second tier are government-funded people. Those are people who do get access to some kind of health care facility. It's generally a broader system that they get incorporated into. They don't have access necessarily to all the latest technology, and they have to fight a lot to get through to the system to get use of it. The third group of people, and that's a group of people we're going to talk a little bit about today, we're going to talk about all of them, are those who are uninsured, who fall through the safety net, who don't have access to a lot of the health care that we traditionally know, preventative health care, when you first get sick, you go there. Their access to health care is primarily through emergency rooms. And that becomes a major problem in terms of cost as well as some other issues. So we do not have an equitable system of healthcare. We have a system of healthcare that functions on various tiers depending upon how much money you have. And one of the things that that I want to look at today is this a system that's going to continue to work for us in this country? There are a lot of things that are occurring that are actually the system is crumbling right around us, even the three-tiered system it is. So, rationing of healthcare. We've always rationed healthcare. We have always rationed health care. It's a new phrase now. People are talking about it now. But in fact, we have. When penicillin was first discovered and proven effective, they rationed initially who got it, what kind of people, for what kinds of diseases, et cetera. And it was very carefully given out. Dialysis. Dialysis, when it was first used clinically, was rationed very carefully. In fact, today it is also rationed, although there is a lot more support for dialysis from government funding. Organ transplants are currently rationed. We do not have enough organs for the number of people who need them. I have one of my staff people in my agency needs a kidney transplant, and she's on two lists, and she's on a list where one, she's 400th on the list, and another list where she is 300th on the list in terms of getting a kidney. So we don't have enough kidneys, and I mean, we don't have enough organs. And one of the issues with organ transplants is that you're not allowed to buy organs. You're not allowed, for instance, to develop a whole industry around organ buying and selling. Why do you think that is? What do you think would happen if you could do it? Well, not only the rich, but people would start selling their organs, which in fact occurs now in some third world countries, where people are they're flown into a developed country, the kidney is taken out and they're flown back. And they get, you know, $2,000 or $1,000. So there are people already who are selling organs. There's also some evidence that there are people who actually are harvesting organs and are actually killing people to do that. But it's somewhere in that area of the same thing as white slavery, which is very quietly talked about, but everybody knows in the medical field that there is something happening there in some parts of the world. Yeah?
There's also cases of wealthy people from other countries, from the
Exactly. It's a very fine line. It's kind of like baby selling, which is, you know, if you give so much to a woman, are you buying the baby or are you just taking care of her health care? And so a lot of this, so we do ration. Beds in intensive care are rationed. There are times when there are not enough beds available. AIDS beds are rationed in many cities, in many parts of the country. Many hospitals will only take so many AIDS patients, or so many of this kind of patient, or so many of that kind of patient. Health care for the poor has always been rationed. It has always been limited to certain things and certain ways of dealing with it. One of the ways to deal with rationing is what? What's one of the things that you can do to deal, not with rationing, but with a healthcare system that is bulging at the seams and people need more things? What do? When you have increased demand, you increase supply. That's the first. The second one is you become selective. Exactly. So those are two choices. In our culture, because of our economy and the way we think, we have a tendency to think, instead of selective, we have a tendency to think of increasing supply. And yet there's a level at which supply cannot be increased anymore for a lot of different reasons. So that's one of the issues. Technology is increasing, and it's becoming more sophisticated. But what else is it doing? It's increasing the cost tremendously. So now we're finding that we have all these ways to keep people alive, but the only people that can be kept alive are those people with money. And they're the ones that a lot of the technology is available to. The other question around the technology is, does the technology give people quality of life, or does it just keep them breathing? And that's one of the issues that's a real struggle in the healthcare field today. One of the issues is you make the decision about rationing, where does it fall? For instance, a preemie baby, and this is an example of one, costs a hospital oftentimes close to $100,000 to keep that child for the first weeks, months of its life, to maintain, to be able to go home. Now, that's just the first level of health care that that child is, that the cost that that child is using up. Chances are, because that child had some conditions that occurred in labor, and because they were premature, they could have things like blindness, deafness, development disabilities. There are all kinds of things, most likely, that that child is going to have to take from the healthcare system for the next 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. So that $104,000 is only the beginning of the cost that costs. In essence, if you gave good prenatal care, and a lot of kids are born prematurely because of lack of good prenatal care, low birth weight, sometimes use of drugs, use of alcohol. Good prenatal care, which costs more in the realm of about $19,000, can prevent huge numbers of these $104,000 or $100,000 babies. And so somehow we need to begin to look at what that means and the weighing of that. If we increase money for transplants and for high-tech medicine, what do we decrease money for?
Preventive medicine.
Exactly. Preventive medicine goes down. Money for people with disabilities, research, and less access and less money available to what group in our society? The poor. So while we, in many cases, are living off the fruits of the land, the fruits of technology, the poor are suffering every time a new machine is invented. Because every time that occurs, money gets shifted over to that and to that part of healthcare and taken away from primary healthcare, which is your basic, keeping people healthy, keeping diseases down to a minimal, childhood diseases, inoculations, that type of healthcare. So, you know, it's a catch-22. High-tech medicine is a catch-22. And I thought of that clearly when I sat in the hospital one night as my father was having emergency bypass surgery and watching all of the equipment in his room and just before he was wheeled into surgery, thinking, you know, thank God it's here, but also knowing that all of that equipment was taking and moving money away from something else. And, you know, somehow in the system, we have to deal with that. So the issue of cost becomes very, very important. Now, the other question is if we're going to ration healthcare, who makes the decision? Do the courts? Do healthcare workers, physicians, people working in healthcare, do elected officials, do our legislators, do you want the government to make a decision about who gets healthcare or not? Community, should it be a local issue? Should it be locally, this is how we want to spend our money, or should it be a statewide issue? Right now, the people who are deciding are those with money. The question is, and I think the issue that we're struggling with all over this country, in California and a lot of other places, is shouldn't we as citizens and as users of the healthcare system be involved in that decision? Should it not be part of what we see as our community responsibility? A lot of us shy away from it because we're real nervous about it. The other issue of preventative care, of cost-effective care, is that preventative care we know is more cost-effective. We know that it saves in the long run, but it costs more maybe up front. And yet, if you look at our federal budgets, and I would presume most of your state budgets, I can only speak for California, the money going into preventative health care in relationship to the population has decreased. We have seen a decrease, for instance, in maternal and child health, in prenatal care. I mean, major problems around prenatal. We spend millions and billions of dollars on dealing with premature babies, and yet we cannot provide prenatal care for all women. In California, where one out of eight babies is born in the country, one out of 14 women never see a doc before they walk in and deliver their baby. One out of 14. And another large percentage only ever see a clinical person, whether it's a nurse practitioner, nurse midwife, maybe in the third trimester. By that time, all kinds of things have occurred and problems will already have come up. So preventative care, we know, is more cost effective, but it requires us to do what in our society?
Educate.
Not only, you know, educate, and to have long-range planning. And in our political system, we have a tendency to deal with healthcare as a political issue. It's what gets us elected. So maybe now we're going to get elected by supporting high-tech medicine, and now the next issue, okay, in 2 years this issue is going to be prenatal care. Well, we've done that for 2 years, so now the politicians move on to AIDS, and then they move on to critical care, and our healthcare system becomes totally fragmented in the process. And that's really what's occurred. Is we have a fragmented healthcare system and it becomes a problem. We've tried to deal with some cost containment measures. The DRGs, which some people may have heard of either as a patient or as a healthcare worker, which is the diagnostic related groups, which decides what kind of healthcare and what kind of tests and how long you stay in the hospital. What it's doing in many cases is it's dumping out some patients who are being dumped out before their time and who are going home and not able to take care of themselves when they're home. It's not a system that people are happy with, but it is a cost containment system, and there are some needs for that. It does, however, prevent hospitals oftentimes from having care available to low-income people. So it has kind of a reverse effect in terms of its cost containment. And I think the issue is this cost containment isn't the only piece of the puzzle here. That's not the only way we decide what good health care is. But let's talk about cost. We spend $1.25 billion a day in health care in this country. It is a major business. In fact, there is a great book out called The Medical Industrial Complex. And if any of you have ever, kind of the military industrial complex, we have all, but this is the medical industrial complex. It's big business, you can imagine, just multiply that times 365 days, $1.25 billion a day. It's almost 11% of the GNP of our country. It's how much we spend on healthcare, and it's not decreasing. It's not going down. So, you know, we're talking about an enormous amount of money. An enormous amount of money is spent for what we call heroic interventions, which is keeping people alive who, after the procedures used on them, they oftentimes die within 2 or 3 days. And yet a large amount of money of our healthcare system goes into that because it's high tech. A lot of it's high tech systems. 20 to 30% of our healthcare dollars are spent on the terminally ill. So you're beginning to see a breakdown of how that money gets used. We need to begin to look at that and make some decisions as society. We are a society that refuses to deal with death. We don't like it, we don't want it, and we think our technology is going to get us out of it. And one of the issues that I think the church can really come in at this point is the whole issue of talking about death and resurrection. That death is not the end. That there are other things that we need to be concerned about. That death is a part of who we are and how we are and how we live on this world. And there's no way our technology is going to keep all of us alive forever. And somewhere along the line, we have to look at that. Consequently, because we have this drive to keep people alive, we oftentimes don't look at the quality of life in the process. And I bet I could go around this room, and almost every person in this room probably knows somebody, either in your family or, you know, with friends, who has been in the position in a hospital of being kept on life support systems that you just wish to God would die. Because it's their time. But we can't quite let go. And it's really difficult, especially for those of us in healthcare who have been trained to believe you save lives. And that's what you do. So it's very difficult to let people die. I was heard Norman Cousins, who's one of the people who works around laughter and terminal illness, etc. And one of the questions asked him in the lecture was, how do you deal with people who really are dying? Because a lot of the work he does is related to getting people to think positively, to live much beyond the expected time that the doctor gave them to live. And we said, how do you deal with somebody who flat out is dying? There's no way. You could be, you know, you can visualize and you can imagery, you can use imagery, you can use every possible thing, and you're going to die. It's, you know, it's over. He said, I'll tell you, it's a major problem for me. Because all of my energy is focused keeping people motivated to live. And it's difficult to talk to people about dying. And I think that's a piece that we need to really look at. We talked yesterday, for those of you here, about some cost related to AIDS. And AIDS really is impacting our healthcare system. Somewhere close to, between $30,000 and $147,000 per AIDS patient if by the year 1991 we have 240,000 AIDS people with AIDS in our country, then you can just multiply the cost to that. AZT, one of the drugs used, $8,000 to $10,000 a year to take it. For people with AIDS, their health care costs are about 20% above other diseases. Direct costs in 1986 were $1.1 billion in the area of AIDS. In 1991, it was projected to be $8.5 billion. Support services in 1986, $7 billion. In 1991, $55 billion. I mean, we're talking huge jumps in terms of care, and we do need to look at support systems. So those are some of the cost issues that we need to look at. That's one side of it. What about people who are uninsured or who have no access to health care? 37 million Americans do not have health insurance. 37 million do not have health insurance. And millions more have insurance that's not adequate. It doesn't really cover anything, you know, except for major medical, but first of all, you pay a deductible of $2,000, et cetera, et cetera. And it becomes really problematic, especially with catastrophic costs. That's really what really decreases. Since 1980, the number of uninsured citizens has been rising by almost a million a year. Million a year of uninsured people. 15 million Americans every year are refused medical services because either they cannot pay or they don't go because they don't think they can afford it. 15 million. Two-thirds of uninsured Americans, or 24 million people, are full-time workers or dependents. So we are now talking about the working poor, people who have full-time jobs with no benefits, with no health insurance tied into their jobs. It's a major problem. Low-income families routinely do not get preventative health care, and they're the group that needs it the most often. When they get their health care, where do they go? They go to the emergency room, which is the most expensive place you can possibly go in the health care system to be treated. But oftentimes, by the time they get there, because they haven't done anything with their problem ahead of time, the problem has become much greater. Uninsured women with families are some of the highest group. Hispanic women, which make up 17% of the population, make up 37% of those uninsured. Black women are 1.5 times more likely than Hispanic women to be uninsured. So we're talking the gaps grow larger and larger and larger. For more than 2 million middle-income families, health care expenses of $3,000 or more hit them every year that are not covered by their health insurance. So, you know, you were talking lots of money piling up along here, lots of bills piling up along here. Uninsured women have a tendency to enter the healthcare system much later, and therefore have they become much more expensive to deal with down the road. Access to health care is a major issue in the 1980s, and we need to begin to look at it and what it means. The nation's problem in terms of access is beginning to hit the polls, and there's some very interesting things that are occurring, which we're going to talk about. But one of the issues that's taking place is a resurgence and reinterest in the issue of national health insurance. And while national health insurance may not be the title, I think, personally speaking, AIDS is going to move us into it. We're not going to have a choice with it. I think it's going to be some form. Now, it's going to be some comprehensive federal policy related to health insurance. It may not be traditionally what we think about in national health insurance or what people call socialized medicine. It probably more likely will be some system that utilizes the current systems we have in place, the current insurance companies we have, hospitals, private doctors, public clinics, etc., using, you know, payment systems, third-party payments, all those kinds of things would probably be tied into it. But I think if we reach the year 2000 without a national health insurance policy and program, we will never have decent health care in this country. I mean, I think that is, we need to do something to deal with health care. And frankly, a country is not very healthy if two-thirds of its population are unhealthy. Even if the upper levels are all healthy, the workers who keep the society functioning and going, if they're not healthy and able to produce, then the society suddenly becomes more problematic. So there are more people who are looking to that. In 1982, there was a poll, and many people responded in that poll that they'd be willing to increase their taxes in order to increase health insurance. In Colorado in 83, there was another study done where 63% of the people said they preferred taxes, increase in taxes to increase health care coverage. California, in just this year, a poll, 73% of Californians said they'd be willing to increase their taxes in order to increase health care coverage. And if any of you know anything about California, they hate to increase their taxes. So that was a major breakthrough. There is a problem. There is a need to deal with the health insurance crisis. And if we don't do something soon, we're going to find ourselves that the system has radically moved ahead of us, and we're not going to be able to keep up and deal with some of the problems that are going to be left along the way. So those are just some of the issues related to the problem of specifically of health care insurance and some of the crisis. Now the questions for us, the second question for us in all of this is what's the church's responsibility in health care? Now traditionally, the church has been a place that when we first arrived in the Americas, one of the things that the churches, our tradition did, is we started a lot of health insurance. We started hospitals. We dealt with TB patients. There were a lot of things. We kind of saw that as our way of doing ministry. It was also our way of taking care of our own. So that shouldn't be missed either. But we definitely provided services for low-income people. And if you look at it, the ELCA has numerous hospitals and nursing homes and all kinds of healthcare facilities attached to it as institutions. There are many, many, many of them. The problem is those institutions have done the same thing in many cases that a lot of other institutions have done, which is they've become more cost-effective, they've become very stable and self-supporting. But in the meantime, what's occurred? Huh? Well, high tech, but who are they not serving as much now? The poor. That's exactly right. And, you know, you can understand some of that. If you want to keep a viable, you know, healthcare system going, you've got to let it pay for itself. But the question then does come to us as church people is, what's our role? What happens to a society where poor people get dumped out of the healthcare system? Who takes care of them? And where's the church in that care? You know, there's something called patient dumping, where a patient who is an emergency room patient goes to a hospital and they decide whether that person is really critical or not. That hospital does not accept anybody who's not insured, and they put them in an ambulance and they whisk them off to the local public health hospital or the next hospital down the way that takes indigent or people who do not have insurance. And what's happened in the process is a number of people have died, of course, when they're being transported from one hospital to the next. It's not legal in many places, but it still occurs on a regular basis. And it happens a lot. It happens a lot in ambulances getting to certain neighborhoods and picking up people who are calling for emergencies. I can't remember where I was recently that somebody was telling me that it took an ambulance 4 hours to get to the scene. Actually, this happened in Oakland. 4 hours, and a young boy whose mother was having a hard time breathing kept calling and calling and calling, and lived in a neighborhood that, you know, some people would have problems going into, others would not, but kept calling for 4 hours. And finally, by the time the ambulance got there, she was dead. And this 9-year-old kid had to watch his mom die because the ambulance never showed up. And probably could have saved her life, because what she needed was oxygen, et cetera. That occurs on a very frequent basis. We don't hear about it a lot, but in certain neighborhoods, it occurs a lot. It occurs a lot. And what does the church do with that? How do we deal with that? What services? Do we do more than just lip service? Do we start beginning to provide advocacy and service to those people? Yes? In some places, in California, patient dumping is not legal. But, you know, there's a lot of, you can't, if a patient is critical and, you know, et cetera, you can't move them. But it's all, the question is who decides whether a patient is critical or not. And so it happens a lot. Particularly it happens to people who are not going to go to the newspaper and tell that it happened. Periodically, a reporter is sitting in the emergency room when it happens and they pick up the story, or somebody in the family does. In most places, it's illegal, but it's done a lot. It's done a lot. So the question for us comes, as a church, when we are involved, you know, if you look at Christ's ministry, how much of his ministry dealt with healing? I mean, incredible amount of Christ's ministry was healing ministry. And how do we, as a Christian community, ignore that part of our society and not be a part of a healing ministry? What does that mean? You know, it was much easier 50 years ago, 70 years ago, to do healthcare because you didn't have high tech. You know, you had the doc in a little black bag who went out and did the house call, and, you know, or you had the nurse who did, the visiting nurse who did it. Now it seems like it's so complicated. And yet, in many ways, preventative healthcare, quite frankly, is not complex. It's just a matter of educating people and motivating people to lead healthy lives and giving them some way to do that. So the question is what kind of ministry of healing are we going to have in the church today? So we need to look. The questions that I'm going to ask you for your small groups are, you know, who should be rationed in healthcare? Should we basically say that we ration healthcare based on age? That we start with the young patient and those who have the longest potential chance of life to live, and those are the people who get the dollars? Should we do it based on criticalness of disease? Shall we pay for preventative healthcare versus high-tech healthcare? One of the cases that you're going to get is the case, is anybody here from Oregon? Okay. One of the cases I'm going to give you is the Oregon legislature did a very, very bold move a couple of years ago, and they reaffirmed that move when the legislature met every year, because I think they meet every 2 years, don't they? Yeah. And what they decided is they felt they had only a certain amount of a pot of money to pay for health care for low-income people. Okay? And they said, this pot, we have to decide how we're going to use it. And this was led, by the way, by a physician who's also a legislator. And basically, the decision they made was, we're going to use this pot of money for preventative health care. We're going to use it for prenatal health care. That's going to be our number one focus and goal in the state. And we are not going to fund organ transplants. What that meant, and soon after that decision was made, there was a young boy who needed a liver transplant, I believe it was. And he came up and he was on state health. His mother was low income. And this little boy, who was very, very cute, 4 years old, just adorable, the perfect, you know, child to put on television, etc., suddenly the state was faced with the fact that the legislature had made this decision, which in theory everybody liked. But now here was the reality. Here was the kid who was going to die unless he got a liver transplant. And the family could not afford it. So he went on television. And they started to raise money. I don't think they ever found the money. He eventually died without the transplant, as I recall. So they really had to deal with it. They're taking a lot of flack for making that decision. And yet, interestingly enough, they've held tough with it. They've said, this is the pot of money we have. This is the only thing we can do. This is what we have to do. But what do you do when you see the four-year-old kid there who could live? How do you make those decisions? That's the first case that I want you to look at. I want you to talk about where you think you would be if you were in the process of making that decision. And number two, where do you think the church ought to be around that? What should the church be saying to that particular situation? And what kinds of things should you be discussing in your own congregation related to that? Yes?
Can I get it by your lecture then that you believe health care is a privilege and not a right?
No, I believe health care should be a right. I think in this country, we oftentimes define it as a privilege. Yeah. Even though we say we believe it's a right. I mean, you remember those five ethical concepts in medical care, and one is equal treatment, access to care. So, but we're talking about a system of care. Would you say the same thing about that?
Not the system.
Right, right, yeah. I think you would have to distinguish between those two things, and I think you're probably right in that. Okay, are you ready to yes?
I'm sure you're familiar. And how far has it gone?
Actually, I just finally met Granger about 3 months ago. We had
he was here a few years ago.
Yeah, up here, right. But basically what he has done is he called the Parish Nurse Program, in which they're doing healthcare programs within some kind of health and wholeness programs within the congregations. And it kind of, it helps to, they actually hire a nurse who's a part of the staff in that congregation and deals with some of the healthcare needs. A lot of them are not necessarily physical, although they can be, takes blood pressures, does preventative care like that, but also deals with the spiritual needs of healing, et cetera. I think that it's a program that is very good. Granger and I had a long conversation about it. I think we're ready to move now to another step, but it's a program that's still very internalized. It's a program that looks in at the congregation. There's some parish nurse programs now that are beginning to do a lot of work out in the community, and I think that's important. I think it's a first good step to getting a congregation kind of aware and conscious. But you know, the issue of healthcare in our country is far bigger, it's much bigger than just what happens in a congregation. People need to understand the politics of it and what that involves, and advocacy. And so I think in some cases the Parish Health Nurse Program is including advocacy. So I see them moving and growing as the times need it. And I think it's a program that's really worth looking at. And he's certainly been a pioneer in the field of looking at health care in the church. So he has, in fact, what's his book?
Good Grief,
yeah, which has been sold out numerous times, but it's a good book. It's a good resource book. Okay, why don't you break up into small groups, and I'll give you about 8 or 9 minutes to talk about that. So the question is, if you had this pot of money, if you were the Oregon legislature and had to make this decision, where would you come down? So have you solved all of the healthcare dilemmas related to rationing? All right. Yeah, great. Okay, we had a quick hand up here. You have to talk loud. Oh gosh, you're starting to pose questions and I've lost control. It's supposed to be my role. Great. You guys have the answers, I have the questions. Yes.
Is it a right to have transplants?
Oh, that's a good question. Is it a right to have transplants? Should that be the same right as the right to health care? Is that a part of the right to health care? Is the right to health care, I would assume even a broader question, mean the right to high-tech medicine?
Yes. And also, is it a privilege to die or a right to die?
Mm. They're too good. Get them out. Get them out. No, it's good I'm leaving today. It's good I'm leaving today. See? Get out while the going's good here. That's right. Those are good questions. And I think, you know, if this kind of discussion takes place in a forum of a church, you know, a congregation, those are excellent kinds of questions to put people through, because they really make us think about all of the issues attached to not only healthcare, but death and dying. And what is it, and again I go back, what is it that we as the Christian community have to say about death and dying? I think we've been very quiet about it. and it's one place that we can really share and give input. So that's a good set of questions. All right, yes, Dale.
Is there a moral Christian obligation to donate our organs to alleviate this problem?
There is a move now to get more people to carry the card around with them, you know, that says if you die in an accident, your body will be donated for your organs. Yes, I mean, there's certainly that, and there should be more use and discussion with that in congregations. A lot of people are very afraid of that because they think their organs are going to be taken while they're still alive. And so who knows? But no, I'm just kidding. The people who do it are very reputable, and that's not a major problem, but it is a fear that people have that you have to get over before you're willing to do that. So, okay, what did people, though, what decisions? I know you guys are trying not to answer my question. It won't work. Tell me what decisions you came up with in your groups. Where would you be? What side would you come down on?
If you're a little boy.
What if the four-year-old boy is your niece or your nephew?
I'd probably resign from the legislature.
It always becomes real difficult when it starts hitting us at home, doesn't it? And that's a real struggle, yeah.
Well, that's where we decided that the church needs to pick up, where the legislature leaves off.
Okay. To help that, to support that family, to possibly provide money to get the transplant.
Or prayer, okay. However it is.
Okay, that the church could do both. It could support the legislature's concept of where the money does the most good, and at the same time deal with the individual suffering of that family.
And hopefully, by preventing medicine, prevent another four-year-old needing the
of needing that. Okay, all right, good, yes.
There may be a millionaire.
That's right.
To
open it up in terms of being I think it, if I can say what you're saying, just so people hear it, is that the sense of community, that justice is an understanding of the community, not just of the individual, and that the gospel message is one in which we talk about the whole people, you know, the entire community and what's good for the entire community. Sometimes that's not always good for just the individual, and that is the essence of the justice question in the gospel, as you've stated. Excellent. I mean, I think that's one of the things you got to struggle with. You know, in our society is very individualistic in many ways. Our religion is in many ways very much in conflict with our societal values around individualism. But it also requires support of that family in a variety of different ways, whether it's through a death process or a grieving process or a healing process, whatever it is. Yes. And that's going to become, we're going to see more and more. I mean, two-thirds of the world does not have access to high-tech medicine. I mean, that in this country alone, but in the world does not have access to high-tech medicine. Yes? You had your hand up.
I think the church can help by keeping more benevolent dollars in the United States.
Keeping more of its benevolent dollars in the United States. Okay, and why would that?
Well, they could set for preventive medicine.
So that, yeah. One of the things that we have to deal with in terms of healthcare and our whole system of economy is that we're very tied into other countries, and we get resources from those other countries. So we take a lot more from the rest of the world than we give back. So there's always a balance there. I think you're absolutely correct that we need to have more healthcare workers coming out of the church. But gosh, you know, we're a big church. We're 5.5 million people. I don't think we need to go and get some of the people who are functioning. Why not take from who we have within our midst and use some of those people to be part? I think it's a good idea to kind of set that up. But I think we still have to have a commitment to the global community as well in terms of our healthcare. Okay, other, yes.
And then I'll deal with you.
But haven't focused on prevention to prevent some of the heart disease. Right. 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 Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to make sure that you talked a little about the Canadian system. One of the issues with national health insurance, or whatever we're going to call it, is that it's not going to look like any other country in the world. And that's one of the arguments always used against it. We can't have a system like this. We can't have a system like that. The reason it won't look like anything any other place in the world is because we already have this incredibly complex medical industrial system already set in place. So you're going to have to take that and play with that. I think your point, and the group's point that you make, that we have now created, the Oregon legislature has truly created a two-tiered healthcare system. And is that acceptable in our society? Is that an acceptable ethical standard? I think that's an excellent point. Is that an acceptable ethical standard in terms of what we do? There is some move to deal with national health insurance on that very with that very strategy, to go and help businesses, small businesses and businesses that don't have health insurance, to help them get health insurance, to subsidize their ability to get health insurance. Because small businesses, of course, pay more for health insurance than large industry does, because it can't afford doing it in such bulk. So when you're a small business, you pay higher premiums to get your health insurance oftentimes. So that's one of the strategies nationally to do that in terms of dealing with that. Tell any other kind of responses to that question?
Ability to pay.
Yeah. It actually, home health care grew a lot out of the issue of patients being moved out of the hospital more quickly and taken care of home. In some cases it works really well, and in others it doesn't. One of the problems is if you get put back into a home that is really not prepared to take care of you and doesn't have the resources within the home, doesn't have the right food, doesn't, et cetera. Even though the other side of it is that people have a tendency to get healthier quicker at home than they do in the hospital. There are more infections oftentimes in hospitals than there are in homes because of the number of people with infections. So it's a real struggle, but I think it's a good point to look at. How many people here think we ought to go to a national health insurance policy program of some kind? Okay. How many people think we're going to do it? That's right. I think that, that we really, again, and how many people think the church ought to be involved in this question related to health care and struggling with it in some form or another?
That's too simple.
Oh. I'm trying to make it easy. I'm trying to get out easy here. The point is that we cannot ignore it. And if we want to be part of the decision-making process related to the kinds of questions asked back here around justice, the kinds of questions asked, do we want to create a two-tiered system? If we want to deal with that and be a part of that decision-making, we need to get involved. And the first way to get involved is at your local parish doing education and getting people, resources and the ability to at least ask the questions. Because what people do around healthcare so frequently and these issues, it gets so overwhelming that they just shut it out. So you have to give people handles by which they can struggle through the questions and come up with some answers and then be a part of their communities. There are a lot of community groups now organizing around the issue of decision-making in healthcare. In almost every state, there's a group related to decision-making in healthcare, and it's happening at the local communities. And I would really encourage you to go out and find out who those people are in your community, to build coalitions with them, to get involved with them, and then to deal with your own congregation around all of the issues that we've talked over this last week, because I think it's important that the Christian community be there at the front of the discussion and not at the end of the discussion once everything's been decided. So that's the time. I want to thank you so much for your time, and for those of you who've been involved over the week, for your good questions and your good answers, and I've really enjoyed it.